Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a very interesting show for you tonight. Last week, if I'm correct, it was August 19th, was the 100th anniversary of the passing of Orville Gibson. And as you can tell by the last name, it's the Gibson, the man who designed all these guitars and mandolins, and he basically changed the face of modern guitar in the 20th century and into the 21st century. So we wanted to honor him, and he had a show on a few months ago, several months ago, with my dear friends Sharon and Greg DeLordo, and they were talking about celebrating his passing and the anniversary of his death. And they were talking about a bunch of different things. They're doing a documentary in progress. And we had discussed then for them to return, come back, and talk more about what's going on and more about this man's fascinating life. So we have a bunch of people here, both in studio and also and over abroad in New York. First of all, the people that are online right now, there's three and very important people. David Nichols, he's known for his custom inlay work, both for Martin, and he's done some stuff on Gibson. We're going to talk about that. And Dick, if I'm saying it right, Dekossis, is that correct, Dick?
Dekossis.
And he's another Orvilleite, if I can call it. And I'll have Sharon give me more of the background. And then over in actually Kalamazoo, Mark Buchnowski, he did a mural. If you are looking at the Facebook Live in the back next to my Barney Kessel, there's a picture of Orville in a very flamboyant suit. It's like a show from it, and we'll find out what that was about. It's on a wall of the building that was the original at that time. It's been rebuilt, but that's where he had his first workshop in was it in Kalamazoo?
In Kalamazoo. The corner of Main and Burdick Street.
So anyway, so that, and then also in studio, Greg Miner, he brought in a harp guitar, a mandolin, an expert on these more exotic instruments, but also just an all-around great player. And it's good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So welcome, everybody. Thank and then you. I'm going to hand over the microphone to Sharon to kind of set the story.
Well, the story began when I was looking through the history books, guitar history books, and found very little about Orville Gibson, and the facts that I did find were conflicting from one book to another. Another thing that was very disappointing is that I realized that this man was responsible for a major name in the music industry, and my husband, Greg, happened to be married to guitars that were built at 225 Parsons Street. So that started me searching. Found this man, Orville H. Gibson, found pictures of his grave, and it was just a little sad looking marker. Nothing really spectacular to show that this man was a very important man in history. So I had the idea, you know, on the 100th anniversary of this man's death, something has to happen. Something has to show at his grave that the world does appreciate what he did, because he changed. I mean, who can imagine? Just think for a moment, what would life be like without all of the guitars that we've had in the last 100 years? I mean, my life would be pretty sad. I wouldn't have a concert in my house every day by my husband. So anyway, I figured, well, how do I get flowers there? So we did a little fundraiser on Facebook and raised several hundred dollars. And I called a lady in Malone, New York, Elaine Gagne of Gagne's Greenhouse and Florist, and she told me about Dick DeCoste and David Nichols. And I thought, okay, well, she said that they're interested in guitars, so I'll give them a call. Boy, was I in for a surprise. I had vaguely remembered reading about Dick in an article when he discovered the birthplace of Orville Gibson. And then I talked to David, and well, was I blown away. But right now, I would like to just ask Dick first to just give us a little bit of background. First, how did you end up with 1,000 guitars in inventory in your store? And then what was it that drove you to try to do what you did with Orville's birthplace?
Well, in the store, music has been in my family for, you know, many years, so I started playing guitar fairly young. And then my dad got into business. He's in the grocery business, just a quick spin here. I took the store over, but I was interested in music, so I started bringing in people knew that I was interested in music and said, well, you should have a little bit of music in the store. And just to make a long story short, we just kept buying this, buying that, bringing it in, and kept adding guitars and getting more lines, more accessories. So now we're pretty much a full-blown music store. And then along the way, I met up with Dave, who we'll be talking to shortly, and he was very helpful in getting me started on making a lot of my own repairs and so on and so forth. So that's kind of how the whole thing evolved over the years. And we started out with 3 or 4 guitars. Now we're on a regular basis, we have about 1,000 most of the time, any day of the week. As far as the Orville Gibson thing, one of my customers way back when, this would be like in the late 80s, early 90s, came into the store, and he was an older gentleman who was just taking up playing guitar. But he said, I read an article somewhere about somebody connected with Gibson being born in Chattagay, and I had never heard it. And so I got checking around a little bit and this and that, and somebody told me about a book written by Tom Wheeler. You know, it was a book about guitars, and it talked about all the different brands. But when I got to the section on Gibson, yeah, sure enough, Tom says he's born in Chattagay, New York. I said, wow, that's like 1 mile away from me. So that's when I started looking for him. And in 1994, when Gibson was going to celebrate their 100th year as a company and business, I had narrowed it down to a couple locations, and I didn't exactly have it. I called a friend of mine in the abstracting business, and he went over to the county clerk's office and searched through all the deeds, and he narrowed down the birthplace, so we finally found it. So we were able to have a nice celebration with some representatives from the Gibson Company, the historian Walter Carter, and Richard Head, executive vice president, were there, and we had a very nice day that day, and we had a nice little music festival afterwards. So I've been trying to track down information on him, you know, ever since. Wasn't much known about him that I could find at that time, but the sources that are available today are so much better, and you can find out so much more about people. But that's kind of where it all started for me, and yeah, I've been pecking away ever since, trying to find out, you know, more and more details. And Sharon, you certainly uncovered a lot of information that I hadn't come upon yet, but I'm going to continue digging locally here to see what else we can find out. But that's how the whole thing kind of started for me. And I want to stick with it. It's very interesting that this guy, as you say, he's probably the best kept secret in Northern New York. A lot of people don't realize that this gentleman was born here and started this huge company, and every really good musician in the world has played on a Gibson instrument of some type one time or another. So very fascinating.
Amen. And you purchased the property?
Yeah, a few years ago, when we first found the property, it belonged to some customers of mine, and they were friends too. And they began mowing the lot and keeping it up at that time because they knew it was kind of a special spot. So I said to the people, you know, if you ever did sell it, I sure would like to get a shot at it. And so unfortunately, the husband of the couple did pass away, and later on the lady decided that she'd lighten up her load and some of the stuff she had. So she did call me and give me the first chance to buy the property. So we did, my wife and I bought it. I was down there the day before yesterday, just kind of mowing the grass and keeping it. There's not much there right now, just a foundation. The local people tell me there were two houses on the site that most people can remember, the older people. The original Gibson house, which eventually caved in, and then some very creative fellows moved another house and put it on that foundation, and then that one's caved in. So, but the foundation is still there, and I'm hoping to maybe erect maybe a gazebo or some kind of a thing on that foundation, and just as a permanent marker. It's about a 2-acre lot. It's not a big lot. Orville's father, John W., worked out by the day, and I looked at the town's old records. So for every day you had to work out, in order to pay your taxes, you didn't actually give money. You worked for the town for whatever number of days it took to pay your taxes. So he only actually worked 2 days a year, so that kind of lets you know that he didn't own a lot of property. But it turns out it was about 2 acres, so I guess it was about a day's work per acre, but I guess it worked out to be. But so we have the lot, and we're going to continue taking care of it for the time being, see how it all goes.
Well, thank you for being a caretaker of Orville's birthplace and carrying on music in the area. And I can only imagine he has a builder, a manufacturer of guitars, to have been honored by a retailer with the type kind of inventory you have. That in and of itself was a huge tribute. So thank you so much for serving with David as masters of ceremonies.
It's a pleasure. And actually, David was very instrumental in the 1994 celebration too. He applied his craft to making some inlaid pearl presentation plaques and a clock with inlaid numbers on the clock, which I think we gave the clock to the landowners, and the inlaid pearl presentation is in the town hall in Chattagay. So he was on it right back then, right from the get-go. So we've had a pretty good working relationship over the years, and I'm proud to know him.
Well,
for sure.
That's great.
You're definitely a great team and cheerleaders for Orville. David, now,
yeah.
One of the very interesting things I found that you said at the tribute for Orville, you were explaining about repairing early Gibson instruments and how that influenced you. Can you elaborate on that for us, please?
Well, I've been building guitars since 1959 and have owned an awful lot of older instruments too. And every time I've had an instrument with any inlay on it of any design, I have drawn and redrawn and built upon every little sliver that I've had to work with. So a lot of the old designs were what I would call floral based, and it's one of those things where when you get started on a project, you have all this depth of knowledge of having seen everything that other people have done, and it's just grown over the years. So I've made pretty much, if it's got strings on it, I've made one or two or a lot. So I've had a really great time doing inlay. I've inlaid for most every major country musician there is, and a lot of the rockers and everything else, but it's been quite a business.
Can you just mention a few of the names that you have provided instruments for?
Sure. The in my mind, Johnny Cash, who was famous from when I was very young to the day that he died, I built his first fancy guitar. And it was black, of course, for the Man in Black, but it was inlaid to my design tastes, which are rather floral, and I had a good time doing that one. I inlaid in the Gibson line a couple of guitars with the name Lucille, and that was for B.B. King, and one year Merle Haggard bought 16 of them to give to some of his buddies, and in the other end of the genre, ZZ Top has got quite a few guitars with different themes on them that they wanted me to come up with. It's just been kind of
David, I was asking a little bit before the show, and I wanted to ask you on the air, do you know of the development where they got the designs, like, for example, the floral headstock inlay for the L5 or the split diamond, like on the Les Paul Custom or the ES355, where those came from? Who designed those?
Well, there are so many influences, and there are so broad. I mean, everything up to and including like a fleur-de-lis, the French floral design, but it's a collection of art from so many years back that it's hard to pinpoint where a lot of it would have come from, but everybody that's been involved has kind of added, you know, their twist to what was there, and I'm sure Orville did the same thing. He would have looked at European-type instruments and, compounded their designs that they had. When you have an artistic talent, you can look, and sometimes when you go to draw what you've looked at, you remember it differently than the actual design that you were drawing. So it comes out, you know, changed by your design habits.
Thank you. Now, that's interesting, because there's just so many designs that are just iconically Gibson in terms of especially inlay.
Well, there's one that's almost iconically Orville, and that's the crescent moon and star. Dave, do you have any thoughts on that one?
I really don't, other than a lot of years ago, astronomers and the study of the moon and stars and the phases of the moon would have been something that would have passed by Orville, and it's like when you have artistic talent, you're influenced by pretty much everything that passes by you in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I might just add, fraternal organizations were very prolific when Orville was alive, and the Crescent and the Star, I think, belong to one of them. And I'm having a brain freeze here. I can't remember the...
Hi, Sharon. Sharon, Mark here in Kalamazoo. I can share an anecdote of something I heard, and I can't recall exactly who I heard this from, but it might be from actually Aaron Cowles, who built mandolins for Gibson. He has since passed away, but from what I recall, he said that Orville had inlay worked with an artist that was in Grand Rapids, and he was from Turkey. And so that's the symbol for the Turkish flag. And he just liked it. And so he wanted to incorporate that on his peghead. That's what I heard.
Well, that would have served double purpose for Orville. Then he would have gotten a lot of mileage, so it certainly makes sense.
Was Orville in any type of organization? Was he a Mason or something like that?
He wasn't a Mason. He was one of the charter members of the Jolly Young Men's Unanimous Club. And that was an organization that...
We should restart that.
that was an organization where they did a lot of charity work for children and needy families, a lot of various churches in Kalamazoo. So they did a lot of fundraising by performing and putting on musicals, theater productions, where they would hand over proceeds, not the entire, they'd pay what they had to pay, and then they would give whatever to the charity.
Well, this is a good chance, time to mention the versatility that Orville had in entertainment. He was an entertainer. And tell us a little bit about that, because he was more than... He played, you can tell us what instruments he played, but also he was an arranger, choreographer. He did musicals. And the picture you can see behind, if you're looking at our live feed, where the Barney Kessel is, there's a picture there of a man with like a little hat with striped pants. That's a picture of Orville in one of the show costumes. And that's actually on the building now that's in the place of where he originally had his first workshop. So can you elaborate a little more on that? Because he was quite versatile, wasn't he?
He was very versatile. He was a man of many, many talents. I believe that his family, when you looked at his nieces and nephews, they were very musical. Singing in church. I think that might have been one of the contributing factors why he left New York for Kalamazoo, because Kalamazoo was really happening with a lot of music. They had the music academy that was in the process of being built, but they also had other venues there. So the music, I think, really drove him. So the man could sing, he could dance, he could, he performed in like comedy skits. His music range was from the ditties of the day mm-hmm. to the common music, you know, the popular music. And then he also did, he sang opera. He sang, this is on February 14th, 1903, he was at the home of a cousin, Maggie Gibson, and he said, or sang, "Then You'll Remember Me," and it was from an opera. So that's why my Facebook page for Orville is Orville H. Gibson, We Remember You. And that's just, I think he sang that song almost in a way a call, "Don't forget me, don't forget me." And so we're choosing not to forget him. But he managed many productions from, when you look back in the records, in 1873 is when we see him in Kalamazoo with music. And then that goes on for the next, 20 years, couple of decades. Mm-hmm. And so he goes from just playing being a drummer, in a marching band. He goes on, and he's recognized for as a harpist, and then a guitarist, and mandolin player. And so he then goes to managing and producing. Today we would call them producers. The way he managed a production, he choreographed. He arranged music for others, and he was really a promoter of talent, of other people's talents. And there was a gentleman at that he knew back in the day who was very young and I think almost shy. His name was Thaddeus McHugh, and that's M-C-H-U-G-H, not to be confused with Ted McCarty. And the man had a wonderful voice, And Orville encouraged him to sing in public. And he did. And then he ended up, you know, he also raised money for charities through his singing. Orville brought banjoists to Kalamazoo. He called, you know, Alfred Farlan, who was a banjoist at the day. A newspaper records Orville calling him a virtuoso banjoist. Now, I would never have thought Orville would be such a promoter and a fan of the banjo, but he was. So he had a lot of interest in just knowing, finding out information about his family. He probably played the piano. It just seems like a very natural thing that he would have done. So those are just some of the things. Mark's absolute masterpiece, Orville's Workshop, was. That was when he was managing a production in 1893. And according to the paper, there was a call for 50 local talents, you know, whether they sang, played instruments, whatever, but they were calling so that number of people. So it was a pretty huge production at the Music Academy. And when he's in that costume, the paper said that he was going to sing, scheduled to sing a Spanish serenade with the Smith sisters. And that kind of explains the sombrero that he's wearing in that picture. But I think he was standing proud because it was such a successful production. They called it an elephant, elephant production, you know, meaning a just grand, huge production. Mm-hmm. So that's some of what Orville was about. And he was always very busy because there was a period of time when he was also performing and building at the same time, building guitars.
Okay. So he what instruments did he play completely? He played guitar, right?
He played guitar. He played the mandolin. He played a harp. I'm pretty sure he played the harp guitar. I don't think there's you know, much question about that, since he, you know, was building, you know, building them early. So we know for sure he played those instruments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are references to multiple instruments, but there's not enough detail in the newspaper articles that I have been able to find.
Yeah, and that must have had a big impact. I'm a firm believer of a lot of guitar companies contemporary. I was mentioning this earlier with both Griggs. The fact that he was a player the impact is invaluable in terms of his instruments, because they're definitely playable. They're definitely versatile and handle all sorts of types of music. And he seemed to be one of those people that was kind of doing everything. So it seems to me that was a big contributing factor in terms of the fact that he played.
Greg DeLordo, my husband, can you... you have played other people's Orville instruments.
Yes.
Can you?
I was just mentioning to Jeff right before we started it, about 2.5 years ago, we were at a store, and they had I believe it was a 1904 Model O, and I was playing it, and Sharon started to record me, and I had no idea, so I went and played. I was just having fun with it. And then she goes, "I just recorded that." And I said, "Well, I wish I would have known. I would have practiced up a little more." Yeah. But anyway, we put it out. We got several actual hits on our Facebook pages. And what was interesting to me is the tone was really, really deep and warm and smooth. And we got several comments about that. And here it is, a 100-plus-year-old guitar that was sounding just wonderful. And that just made me think of, you know, Orville built with a musical purpose in mind. Everything he built had musical purpose. And he built in, and that musical purpose would be tone and timbre, and then, of course, projection, because the instruments had to compete with with other instruments of the day, you know, drums and horns and louder sounding music. So the violin was the only instrument that was able to accomplish that, and that was because the violin was so high tech for the day. Mm-hmm. The Stradivarius violin had already been out. Orville Hitch had actually encountered one. But the projection and the quality of the tone, it wasn't just loudness, it was actually also the quality of tone, the playability. This comes from being a musician. And built with tone properties, and Orville actually guaranteed his instruments. Mm-hmm. So he stood behind him, and this is something that, that today we don't have, but back in the day, Orville put his name on it. Those were built by him with his approval, and those instruments were playable, they were built to last, they had tone, timbre, projection, and they were built with a musical purpose.
Go ahead, whoever was interjecting. Hello? Did anybody have anything to say?
They're shy.
Oh. They're shy.
They're shy.
Go ahead, Greg.
Greg Miner, you have a couple of instruments here today. So,
but I don't have Orville's.
Well,
I have later Gibson instruments.
But
they're based on Orville's designs.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Right.
So the mandolin, the F4 1907 here, is a three-point, meaning it's got an extra point here. For those of you watching on Facebook or later looking at this clip, you'll see the standard two points from the F4, the typical bluegrass mandolin. Mm-hmm. But Orville's had a third point on the left. I don't know why he did all these points. It wasn't to make it like to poke you in various body parts. It was more of an aesthetic thing. Mm-hmm. And he had just a fantastic imagination and aesthetic, I think, on all of his instruments, particularly the F mandolins. So from the front, this really looks like one of his instruments. He would have probably had the pick guard that went across the low at the bottom rather than on the right side where we have them today. And then if you turned it around, you will see that the back and the sides are standard, you know, bent sides and a typical more or less carved profile back, in this case one piece in 1907. But from the front it's Orville's. He then had, of course, a pan back and carved slab sides, pretty much were a bass that was just not meant to resonate, but to bounce sound off of. And of course, his tops were carved, as the other Greg noticed, carved very differently than the Gibson Company would carve them later.
Before you put that back, could you give us a strum or two?
I could. Now, we were commenting between all of us here, you can't see it on the camera right now, but the strings are, the neck and fingerboard are literally straight across the instrument, and there's almost zero break angle at the bridge. It's just laughable. And the fingerboard doesn't arch back as a violin or an F5 would later. And yet, somehow, it sounds great. It's about as loud as my 1915 F4 with that same bark. Nothing really to complain about. It's just as easy to play.
What was the advantage of angling the neck? Why did he do
more
that?
More string pressure on the soundboard to activate it.
Down pressure.
Yeah.
That's pretty live, though. Is there a
it
lot
is.
Of bracing under that, or is it pretty just...
I haven't x-rayed it or gone in there, but I'm sure there's views online that you could find. So I don't know how it compares with the later instruments or the later F4, actually.
Okay. I'm waiting to see. We lost the video feed had frozen, but it should be up again. It should be up on now, so I'm going to reshare it. But real quick, just grab that man and explain that 3 point.
So, yeah, we were looking at the 3 points of the early F4 1907, and Orville came up with this design in the late 1890s, or middle 1890s. We don't really know. And so Gibson, the company, kept his design for about would have been about 4 or 5 years. And his design is the third point here. The later F model mandolins have this point, and this one is going up. And that's in the oval hole mandolins and then the classic bluegrass mandolins as well. But unlike the later mandolins, this one doesn't have a break angle of the bridge or the neck. They're both, they're just straight across. And of course, this has deformed some, but not much. So this is how they strung them so heavy back then that they got enough tone out of it. Ouch. It's killing my headphones.
That's pretty responsive. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So, okay.
And then this guy.
Yeah, let's take a look at that one.
Well, another Elbel design. This is his large harp guitar. Now, he did a six and a... Well, he did a couple experimental instruments, of course. There's one in the Gibson basement or archives, which stands on the floor. It's about this big, but it stands on the floor with sub-bass strings on the across the body, actually. But then he came up with these designs, and there was a smaller one with six sub-basses and a large one with 12. So this is a full chromatic scale. And the company, I don't know if Orville did this or you thought about it, but the company would color code the strings. So every third string was copper, and plain strings were silver plated copper, so that you could color code them sort of like a concert harp has C's and F's in color. This has every third string in color, so you can find your place. 12 chromatic bass instruments. So this would be unlike the later Gibson harp guitar, which is a high tuning in the sub basses of 10. Count of 10. This is starts at the E of the neck and goes down chromatically, so E flat. Pretty cool, huh? So what I have here is sort of decorative strings. These are made for a different instrument, and they're nylon. They're silk and nylon core. There's no steel core. And the same with these. These are silk and steel strings. So you're not getting a sense of what this really sounded like. You're not getting a sense because back then, they built these with a quarter inch. I don't know if you can see that on the camera, but it's a quarter inch thick carved top. And to drive that, they recommended, in fact, they almost insisted that you could not get any tone out of it without doing this. They would throw away their E string. This is with gut strung guitars or steel string guitars. They throw the E string away, they take the B and put it here. They move over every string over one. Now think of doing that to any of your guitars today. You wouldn't. And none of us today would do that to an antique Gibson instrument. So to this date, I have never heard anyone play an Orville or an early Gibson instrument strung as they recommended, which means moving every string over one, the low E string would take a C string off a cello, and that's your low E string, and then the harp sub basses would have been done similarly out of silk and steel, steel or nylon.
Are those are silk and steel, right? On
these
the six string
yes.
part too?
Right. And I've got this tuned down, for those of you with perfect pitch, it's tuned down a half step because this is a 27 1/4 inch scale compared to the normal 25 1/2. And again, that was an idea of Orville's, and then the Gibson company kept that to, again, put more tension, a longer scale tuned to the same pitch. You're putting even more tension on this top. The idea was they built the top to project like no one else's instrument in the world, and this was certainly Orville's idea.
Now, is there a truss rod in that neck?
There is nothing. Oh, in the neck, there is nothing. No.
Okay, that makes it even more delicate.
No, in fact, Orville's early instruments had a hollow neck. That was a little tone channel to get a little bit extra volume and tone. I don't know that that really helped. But so none of us can really hear what his instruments, and you know they sound wonderful, and I played the Orville harp guitar that sounded completely different from this, just beautiful. But we still don't have a sense of what it really sounded like because we don't want to risk stringing it.
The old string.
So heavy that we might, of course, implode.
And nobody has made one from the old blueprints.
No one that I know of. Mm. No. So you'd have to do an experiment carving it like Orville. Now, again, the carving is part of his secret, and that was fun getting the Orville harp guitar for our exhibit last year, owned by Phil Rowan. And it was an R size, the smaller one, and it still blew all the harp guitars in my collection away. And his carving was different from the carving you see here, which is sort of a general, you know, it's sort of sloping up gradually, and it is sort of, the top is, it's flattish. Ooh. I'll send you my insurance claim. But the Orville had like a real steep carve here, and it immediately went up about 3/4 inches, and then very flat top. And my feeling was that transition here was carved in such a way as to thin out this edge, like a violin, or and the transition. So the top was similarly thick, not quite the quarter inch you see here, but pretty darn thick. But it seemed like it acted more like a hi-fi speaker. So it's
vibrating.
That is vibrating on the rim, mm-hmm. and that had just a wonderful resonance and tone. More so than any of the later Gibsons.
Now, didn't the original design of his arch tops, which is his,
yes,
I think it's patented, right?
Yes.
It's different than the later guitars, right? And how was it different? It was a solid piece, or
well,
it was carved?
You're thinking of the back and sides, which is very interesting, because and I don't know that it's a bad idea, frankly, but everyone, you know, of course, laughed about it, and Gibson immediately changed it, and that's probably a lot of the things that pissed Orville off back then. So this has standard bent sides, you know, and then a standard carved back. This one's a little bit flat. His back, again, had a very steep carve from the edge to about 3/4 inch up, and right about here, the entire back was flat, but it was also quite thick. It was like a pan, and it was built on a giant... It was like a giant assembly of wood from here to there was one giant slab of walnut or mahogany, mm-hmm. that he then carved out, and the sides and the back were all one piece. And in fact, the back went up to about yay on the neck. This is part of the back, and just one giant chunk of wood that he laminated together and then carved, and it was, I guess, for stability. I don't know if it added or detracted from the tone. It might have made a great resonating chamber for whatever magical carving he did for the top.
Oh, okay. But I thought the original ones, he carved that top into a arch, as opposed to later on they treated the wood to bend it.
Right? Well, there are many bent arch tops, but a Gibson, I think, is always carved.
Yes, carved tops. Yeah.
Even the newer L5s, they're still carved tops.
Yes.
There's a lot of fake bent carved. I mean,
arch tops. No.
As you know, it's hard.
But
to
that's significant, because it definitely is a different sound with that solid piece of wood.
Right.
Absolutely.
Which is unique to, I mean, that's right. The most popular jazz. That guitar, Barney, is that a solid piece?
That's a solid piece.
That's a solid piece.
So I want you to move every string over one and play it. Come on, those jazz guys.
That has a nice dress. Yeah, but I don't have the drone strings. But, no, that's interesting. And that was a pretty...
At weighs that time, a ton. But
there were other arch tops, but there was nothing close to that at that time.
There was a few arch top harp guitars later, one or two, mm-hmm. but much later than Orville, maybe the 1910s.
Now, were some of the I'm trying to think of some of the competitors of that time of his, D'Angelico, was that a solid top, or was that...
D'Angelico would have been all carved.
Would have been carved top, too.
Now, of course, much later than Orville, but...
So that would have been too. So
a different,
to get a perspective.
A different similar skill.
Yeah.
In the magic carver.
Mm-hmm. Now, the harp guitars, when was their golden era in terms of, I'm sure they
today.
Were popular. Actually, more today.
Well, no. We're having a resurgence at the moment, but no, back then they were extremely common. In America's craze was the 1890 to about 1920.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Orville came in and sort of about 10 years after they had appeared in the, after the Harwood Jenkins instrument in 1888 or so. And then the Chicago exploded with flat top harp guitars. And soon the Larsons in Chicago, the Larson brothers, would build Dyer's harp guitar pattern after Knutson, who's in the Northwest. And then Orville was probably building by 1898. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much before. He could have been building years before. We don't know yet.
The earliest, I know the newspaper, the earliest account I can find in the newspaper said that it was 1888, and it talks about several instruments that he has built already.
I think I saw that quote recently in Paul Fox's book, the mandolin book. And there's a clue. They describe it as in a way that points to the harp guitar and nothing else. And that might be the early 1888, which would be really early. And putting Orville as one of the co-inventors of the American harp guitar, as I sort of speculated mm-hmm. in an exhibit book, mm-hmm. that he was a harpist. He mm-hmm. was doing these incredible lyre mandolins and mm-hmm. fanciful pointed Florentine instruments. Why not combine a harp and a guitar mm-hmm. as a wonderful experiment, and so he may have invented it independently from the guys in Chicago, Missouri, and Knutson in the Northwest, et cetera.
Well, I do believe that the reason he wanted to improve the sound of the instrument is because, in many respects, I see him as a very humble man, a very honest man, a man of his word. But I also see a great ego when on stage. And he, I think, wanted his instruments to be heard above all others. So if, you know, he's playing with other players, he's going to try to make a better sounding instrument. I would like to move, Greg, did you?
I was just going to interject, you know, he did build a violin, and he was
many violins
in violin building. So when all this started, he used a lot of the violin principles and construction methods that were used before, and going back to Antonio Stradivari, that's where he got that, and he learned that that violin projected above the orchestra. So I think that had something to do with it as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'd like to move on back to Kalamazoo and Mark. Now, Mark.
Hello from Kalamazoo.
Mark, can you just tell us a little bit more about the mural and what it took to actually get that done? Mark is in the green shirt here, what is going to be happening with the mural? How long will it be up? And I guess I'm not going to ask you to tell all of the labor that you went through, but at least to tell us, what did it take to actually put it up?
Well, thanks, Sharon. Actually, most of the work came from your encouragement, so that really made me keep following through, because it was, you know, it's just a piece of paper really on the side of a building, but it really took a lot of effort to convince the building owner and to make sure that, you know, putting anything on his building was going to not hurt his marble, because maybe I'll back up. You know, I'm always attracted to 225 Carson Street, and that was one of the reasons I took the interview to come to the Kalamazoo Gazette 20 years ago, because I thought I would be able to see the factory, and I did. And, of course, as you can also testify to going into that building, there's a sense of magic that, you know, when you go across the work, the workspaces and the dust and the wood chips, and just the sound and everything of things being done by hand that was still practiced, you know, in the way it had been done for decades. And so over time, of course, after working for the newspaper, I became very curious about the origin of Orville Gibson, and looked through a lot of anecdotes and, you know, records around the city, especially in the library, and was trying to piece together where these original workshops were, because the names of the streets had changed. And this, especially the shop where he seemed to make that transition from being an entertainer to becoming a full-time instrument maker. And that must have been, or I would assume, would have been 104 East Michigan, or actually East Main at the time, right on the corner of Burdick and East Main, which is now East Michigan and the Kalamazoo Mall. And the buildings that are on that corner have gone through a renovation back in 1916. First National Bank bought that block, removed his address, which was 104 and 106, and built this large atrium between 102 and 108. And it was a bank for decades after, you know, the original buildings were gone. And then sometime in the 70s, a tornado came down through Kalamazoo, and that building took a big hit, and it was covered with marble in the 70s. Well, it's gone through many other banks after the First National Bank, and it was left empty. And a local developer here in Kalamazoo, who works in mostly high-end luxury apartments downtown, Tom Huff, bought the building, converted all the spaces, the the sort of nooks and crannies into luxury apartments. He kept the atrium. And last year, he pulled back the interiors of the atrium and revealed the brick of 108 and the interior of 102, so the two bookends of that building. And behind all that was the original facade or the interior, the tin roofs of the original 102 and the gips work in the ceiling. And it was really fascinating to see. But on the outside of 108, there were theater posters that were wheat pasted onto the wall, the brick, and these were for shows that were at the Four Theater that was on Burdick, which is the Kalamazoo Mall. And it was just really interesting because they were preserved behind that interior. And it was one of the last stories I did for the Gazette before I left that business, and it just gave me the idea that we really needed to honor Orville Gibson, because it's kind of sad that there really isn't anything in downtown Kalamazoo that recognizes that this is where the birthplace that was of or is for Gibson Guitars, or even where Orville Gibson had work. I mean, people know 225 Carson Street, and the continued legacy of Heritage Guitars, but there's nothing really to recognize Orville Gibson. Well, knowing that this anniversary of this 100th anniversary of his death is coming up this month, I thought, well, there's theater posters. I'd like to do that on the outside, on the exterior of the marble, just to let people know that this is where it was. This not a lot of people know the origin of Orville Gibson, that across the mall was a shop that he started at in the back of a music store, and then he grew so fast that he went into his apartment in the second floor of 104 and started working full-time making instruments. And then some investors bought into his company, bought his brand, and down in the alley they opened a factory, the very first factory, which was right downtown Kalamazoo. So I always thought the photograph of Orville wearing that ridiculous costume was just so entertaining, because what was he trying to say? What was going on in that picture of this, obviously not your normal clothing, and the little tiny sombrero? Well, it just, like, this guy's a character. So I thought that would be the thing to plaster on the wall on the outside of the building on his on this 100-year anniversary. And then I recently saw the movie Faces Places about J.R., a French muralist that uses photographs and plasters them on buildings in Europe, especially in Paris. And I thought, that's it. That's just make a really gigantic picture of Orville. And I want to do it in that costume. So originally I was going to just use bond paper, have it printed in little tiles, and then use wheat and paste and assemble it as large as I could on that building. But it's marble. And one of the conditions the owner said was, well, you can put it on, but if anything goes wrong, you have to restore my marble back to the original condition. It's like, whoa, that's got to be expensive. So, that made me think of other ideas, like, well, once a year they have Santa Claus down on the mall, and I thought I'd make a big billboard and put it where the Santa Claus is, or something like that. And then the city said, well, that's going to cost you to pay for an encroachment permit, and you have to get an engineer to sign off on your billboard. So back to Tom Huff, I said, we got to work this out. So this is the building. This is the building. Behind this wall is where Orville really got into it. This is where the dude did it. And talking to the printer, a local printer, Cal Blue, they suggested that I use vinyl, that it was going to give a photographic quality, it was going to be the highest resolution. And they had several different products that actually had an adhesive already built into the product. So all we really needed to do was press it on the marble, thinking the marble was going to be a good surface to attach this to. So it's about 13 feet in height and almost 60 inches wide. And that fit just in the printer. That was the max the printer could make. And so it went up on Sunday. And so far, people have seemed to enjoy it.
I would like to just mention the photograph. We should give thanks to Roger Siminoff for providing you with. Can you just tell us a little bit about that tintype and?
Real quick, because we're around time.
Yes, I really don't know a whole lot more than what Roger told me, that it's 8x10 tintype, and I don't know how many copies they would have made of that, but I noticed at least two copies of the picture, because one is reproduced in Julius Belson's book, The Gibson Story, that has O.H. Gibson written across the top, and no, the picture does not. And he has that, as he said, in a safe, and he scanned it and then shared the copy with
you. Okay, thank you.
We're out of time. I knew this was going to go by fast. But real quick, I want to give everybody's information, if you want me to. Dick DeCasas, his store is called Dick's County Store and Music Oasis. And they're in Churubusco, New York. And should I give them, Dick, should I give them the desk number? Is that the number for the store?
Yeah, the music shop is 518-497-6054.
Okay, so that there's more. You got to check out those. He's got all those guitars there too. David Nichols, Custom Pearl Inlay. Do you have? Can you give us your information? A website or phone number?
Yeah, my phone number is 518-483-7685, and remember our time zone difference.
Yeah, they're in New York.
Yes, New York State. I have a website, custompearlinlay.com.
Okay, so you do custom work for people can bring in instruments, and you'll do custom work for them.
Oh, I inlay for an awful lot of the small builders, every major company. I've inlaid for pretty much every guitar builder of the big companies and an awful lot of the smaller ones.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're awesome.
Yeah.
All the Martin stuff, I follow the Martin stuff, and I love, they're just beautiful instruments. And at some point in the future, we got to do a show just on inlay. So just keep that in the back of your head. And then Mark Bugnoski Photography,
yeah.
And give your number out and web.
Well, the best way to reach me is just Google search my last name. There's not too many of us. It's Bugnaski. And I just put up a new website called theimagearts.com. And I'm a photographer for hire.
Okay, there you mm-hmm. go. And then Greg?
Just Google harp guitar. You can't not find me.
That's Greg Miner.
Yeah, but started my own site, Miner Music, M-I-N-E-R, music.com.
And everything, Miner Music.
Everything leads from there.
And Greg? My Greg?
Your Greg.
Your website?
GregDelorto.com? Yes.
Right, GregDelorto.com. That'll get me. And also Facebook is Delorto Guitar.
Okay. And you have a site for Orvalites?
I have a site for Orvalites, and that's, I want to thank all of the Orvalites in this room and in Kalamazoo and in New York. And that is, Facebook is Orville H. Gibson, We Remember You. Now, I do have some other Facebook pages, but that's the one. I just want to say, I want to encourage everyone who is an Orvalite in any level, think about doing something this year to really honor him, to pay tribute to him. Whether you write a song, write a poem, I doubt somebody is going to put another mural up somewhere, but, you know, think about doing it. This is the year of Orville H. Gibson.
Everybody pull those old Gibsons you have in the closet and start playing them. That's it.
Sharon, we need a statue. We need a statue for Gibson and Kalamazoo.
We do. We're going to get it. We'll do it.
Thanks, everybody.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Everybody hang on the line until the show's off the air. We'll talk real quick. Everybody have a great show, a great week. Greg, Sharon, Dick, Mark, David, thank you so much. Everybody, we'll see you next week.